From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, the 1st of April, 2009. The war in Afghanistan has a new front. The top U.S. commander tells lawmakers that Pakistan is now part of the conflict. The government's fusion centers have been criticized for violating free speech and privacy. We'll hear why Congress will keep funding them. And we'll visit one of the country's growing tent cities where residents say they will not be moved. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
Get the troops out now! Get the troops out now!
Get the troops out now!
Thousands of protesters crammed into the streets of London today ahead of the G20, the meeting of the world's 20 largest economies, which opens tomorrow.
Troops out the Middle East!
No justice! No peace!
Troops out the Middle East!
Police presence in the financial district was large as well. Although a majority of the protests were nonviolent, reports of police clashes and vandalism have emerged. According to the AP, protesters broke into the Bank of Scotland. Individual reports from protesters being posted on Twitter from within police lines claim police dogs are on the scene and that authorities are severely restricting the movement of demonstrators. The Department of Justice dropped corruption charges against former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens today, overturning a conviction that tainted his re-election campaign. Peter Granitz reports from Washington.
Last fall, a judge convicted Ted Stevens of intentionally leaving large gifts off disclosure forms. But today's decision by the Justice Department means the former senator likely won't spend any time in jail. In a statement, Attorney General Eric Holder said it was in the interest of justice to dismiss the indictment, saying certain information should have been provided to Stevens' defense in the original trial, but wasn't. The DOJ kept private an interview with Bill Allen, a friend of Stevens, who admitted to providing gifts to the then-senator. The gifts were valued at about $250,000. Most came as improvements to a second home in Alaska, but notes from the interview with Allen indicate the goods and services were worth about $80,000. The conviction came soon before Stevens' failed re-election campaign. Former Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich won that election. Holder said the DOJ's Office of Professional Responsibility will investigate the prosecution's conduct further. Peter Granitz, FSRN, Washington.
A North Dakota bill giving a human fetus the legal status of a human being from the moment of conception may have been effectively killed by a legislative committee today. The North Dakota Senate Judiciary Committee recommended that the Senate vote the bill down. But as John Pike reports, the campaign continues its push to extend personhood to fetuses as a way of challenging abortion rights.
The North Dakota Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously voted down the personhood bill, which would extend the legal status of a person to every organism that carries the human genome, including fetuses. The bill's sponsor, Dan Ruby, said in news reports that the legislation was meant to challenge Roe v. Wade. The bill already passed the North Dakota House of Representatives 51-41, and under North Dakota law, the Senate must still vote on the bill. But the unanimous committee recommendation to vote against the legislation does not bode well for its success there. Despite the unfavorable news in North Dakota, the so-called personhood movement is continuing its work, organizing a petition drive in Mississippi and introducing bills in other states. John Pike, Free Speech Radio News.
Russia and the United States say they will reopen talks aimed at reducing the country's arsenal of nuclear warheads. The new deal would bring the number of warheads below levels agreed to in 2002. The Carnegie Endowment for International Peace estimates that both countries currently possess more than 3,000 warheads each. The UN Human Rights Council today extended their blessing to the United States' bid to join the group. Former President George Bush did not opt to join the council, which was formed in 2006. Yesterday, the Obama administration announced its intention to gain membership. The U.S. could actively take a seat on the council following the body's elections in May. A new right-leaning Israeli government took office yesterday, and in the wake of the power shift, some Palestinians are less than encouraged. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
The ruling Hamas party in Gaza sees Israel's new government as a continuation of what it calls a racist policy that never recognized the Palestinian people's right to self-determination. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called on Netanyahu's government to return to the state of mind that reigned prior to the outbreak of Palestinian-Israeli violence in 2000. Abbas said this would allow negotiations between both sides to achieve a long-lasting peace. Palestinians also reacted to the new Israeli government. Atif Isa is a Gaza resident.
The government reflects the attitudes prevalent on the streets of Israel. The war in Gaza has allowed this kind of government to come to power.
Newly elected Israeli PM Benjamin Netanyahu outlined his peace process policy by hinting at allowing limited autonomy for the Palestinians based on 1967 borders. In another news, the Israeli army clashed with a group of Palestinian fighters on the border yesterday, killing two. One Israeli soldier was injured. Rami Almirari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
In Argentina, the man who led the country into democracy in the 1980s after the bloody military junta died last night, Marie Trigona reports.
Former President Raul Alfonsín died last night from lung cancer at the age of 82. Thousands lined up outside Congress in the nation's capital to bid farewell to the former president, said to be a symbol for democracy. Today and Thursday have been declared days of mourning. The deceased Alfonsín was elected president in 1983, following the collapse of the 7-year ruling dictatorship. State representatives and human rights advocates celebrated Alfonsín as a president who criticized the military junta and later brought some measure of justice to victims of the junta's violence by prosecuting members of the military. President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, who is now in London for the G20 summit, will return earlier than expected to visit with the former president's family. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. A pair of assumed U.S. drones struck Pakistan today, killing 14 people. This is the first time the Orakzai region, which lies near the border with Afghanistan, has been attacked. The strike took place after Pakistani Taliban leader Baitullah Masood asserted his group is responsible for a deadly attack in Lahore in retaliation for U.S. drone attacks on Pakistan and threatened attacks on U.S. soil. Meanwhile, General David Petraeus told lawmakers in Washington today that the U.S. is investigating the threats and responding to them. He added that the war in Afghanistan has now become the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan, a single war, which he said would be long and sustained. Although lawmakers praised this new strategy, some are concerned that the plan fails to lay out how the terms of success will be measured. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
Less than a week after President Obama unleashed his new plan for Afghanistan and Pakistan, and just 2 days before the start of a NATO conference, General David Petraeus provided lawmakers with some more details.
Afghanistan and Pakistan comprise a single theater that requires comprehensive, whole-of-governments approaches that are closely coordinated.
General Petraeus asked Congress for support.
Disrupting and ultimately defeating al-Qaeda and the other extremist elements in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and reversing the downward security spiral seen in key parts of these countries will require sustained, substantial commitment.
The administration is calling the plan comprehensive, comprising of military and intelligence action, as well as economic building and infrastructure. Even some of Obama's toughest critics expressed support. Republican Senator John McCain.
I believe that the strategy that the president and his team have developed for addressing the enormous challenge of Afghanistan is a good one, and I think it has every chance of success.
But concerns arose as the administration has been silent on how success will be defined. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine questions Undersecretary of Defense Michelle Flournoy.
How will you know whether or not this new strategy is working? It seems to me that you need a set of clear benchmarks, clear metrics going in.
I think we're in the process of developing them. The decision to deploy the additional forces was driven, there was a sense of urgency by our commanders on the ground.
Obama is sending 17,000 troops to Afghanistan and an additional 4,000 to train Afghan security forces. As for Pakistan, Obama rarely mentions military action, even though U.S. drones conduct attacks such as the one today that killed 14 people. He and his military commanders instead speak publicly about economic aid for Pakistan. They're asking Congress for $1.5 billion per year, five times current aid levels, for economic development. Top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, Carl Levin, has his doubts.
We can't buy their support. They've got to believe in those goals for their own security interests. We can't be trying to persuade them to do something that they otherwise wouldn't do on their own. They got to want to do that on their own to go after the religious fanatics for their own reasons, in which case then our support can be effective.
Steve Clemens, director of the Foreign Policy Program at the New America Foundation, says country building is a difficult prospect.
My criticism is that the idea that you can basically try and apply in this transnational context a methodology that looks anything like what Petraeus oversaw in Iraq looks like a mistake to me. And I worry about the increased obligations, the increased troop deployments, the increased chances for, blowback for having a heavier military footprint in this region.
After the G20 conference, Obama will travel to the NATO conference Friday, where he'll push for more support for the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The Bush administration created more than 40 fusion centers following the September 11 attacks. These offices are created to expedite the sharing of information between different local, state, and national security agencies. The centers also collect data from the private sector. The sharing of information between the military, the government, and the private sector has brought fusion centers under scrutiny, and reports that they've targeted anti-war activists and third-party supporters have caused critics to cite fusion centers as a potential threat to a citizen's right to privacy and free speech. FSRN's Sam Greenspan is in Washington, where a congressional panel today weighed the promise and danger of these fusion centers and indicated they will continue funding them.
Representative Keith McCall, Republican from Pennsylvania, says that fusion centers are a necessary component for protecting the country from terrorist threats.
You know, after September the 11th, big allegation was we weren't connecting the dots and we weren't sharing information. And the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing, and that there wasn't any coordination with state and local law enforcement.
More than 20 states, plus the District of Columbia, have fusion centers. This is the first investigation of fusion centers under the new presidency and the new Congress. Most of the dissent at Wednesday's hearing came from Bruce Fine of the Litchfield Group.
And they assured us that the only people being spied on were those who are known al-Qaeda agents. We have no ability to know whether that's accurate. If that were true, we are puzzled as to why both the previous and this administration continue to invoke state secrecies to conceal from us who was spied on and why and what was done with that information.
In an article in today's Washington Times, Fine wrote that to a hammer, everything looks like a nail. The ACLU is calling for more oversight and an evaluation of whether fusion centers produce security valuable enough to justify the expense. Matt German is with the ACLU's National Security Policy Council.
We haven't taken a position that the fusion centers should be closed because we don't know exactly what the fusion centers are doing. And, you know, there may be some things that they're engaged in that are perfectly appropriate, but we don't have the tools necessary to find out exactly what the fusion centers are doing, and that's why we rely on Congress.
This attitude of continued use, along with investigation, seems to be in concert with the sentiment of the committee, who will most likely continue the use of fusion centers with this new administration. For FSRN, I'm Sam Greenspan.
During this recession, the Congressional Black Caucus is reminding the administration that it's not just their portfolios that need diversifying. Caucus members charge that minority and women-owned businesses have been left out of economic recovery plans. As Tanya Snyder reports, the caucus convened a meeting between business owners and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke to try to design a more inclusive program.
Robert Wallace is the CEO of Bith Group, a private equity and energy management firm. He says his company could have helped manage the bailout if they'd gotten a contract.
We could provide some help in terms of the assets, the whole credit management area. You know, how do you get more done with less? So we could have helped in that.
But the Treasury Department was in such a hurry to get the bailout moving that they ended up relying on the people they knew, often the same people blamed for causing the collapse in the first place.
Follow the money, and the policies. They always leave a trail. And you'll find that if you follow the money and you follow the trail, you're not going to find women and minority businesses engaged or involved.
When they approved the bailout, Congress gave Treasury permission to skirt rules designed to increase minority participation. Janice Ogletree represents the TARP Minority Accounting Group, a business coalition that came together to try to get some of those contracts.
Treasury Department gave out two accounting contracts. Those two firms have all of the accounting work associated with TARP. All of the billions of dollars. We are simply asking for an opportunity to participate as small and minority businesses in the TARP work, and we've not been afforded an opportunity to do that.
The Treasury set a requirement that accounting firms managing the bailout money had to have at least $500 billion in domestic assets. Other management firms also had high bars set for participation to ensure that firms had experience managing large sums of money. Pennsylvania Representative and Black Caucus member Chaka Fatah says those rules froze out small businesses.
That automatically locks out all of the women and minority asset managers in the country, even though some of them are the most successful asset managers in a very difficult marketplace.
People of color own only 18% of U.S. firms, according to the most recent statistics available from the Small Business Administration. The SBA reports that for every dollar a white-owned firm makes, black-owned firms make 43 cents. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee tried to create an Office of Minority and Women Inclusion to bring these businesses into the bailout program.
If the American economy is to recover, then it must expand its wings to encourage small businesses, minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses to be part of that recovery. If they do not have a seat at the table, then this recovery will collapse, plain and simple, because the underpinnings of the economic engine are the small businesses of America.
Jackson Lee's proposal to encourage diversity among those managing the bailout never made it out of committee, but the Congressional Black Caucus isn't giving up. They brought together more than 300 business representatives this week for an access summit to address barriers that minority and women-owned businesses face when bidding on federal contracts. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke addressed the gathering, which was closed to the press. Congresswoman Maxine Waters described Bernanke's remarks.
So they welcome the opportunity to get input from minority professionals to help them better organize ways by which all of our society can participate.
But Waters made it clear Bernanke's comments hadn't lulled her into any false sense of security.
What we know when we do this kind of work is this, that when they come, they will offer to cooperate. What we also know is it doesn't get done unless we put specifics in their hands.
Waters pledged that her new task force on economic security will continue to pressure the administration to open up opportunities for women and minority-owned businesses to participate in federal contracts. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
The National Alliance to End Homelessness says that an additional 1.5 million people could be left homeless, a third of them children, because of rising foreclosures and the recession. By one estimate, the tent city in California's capital, Sacramento, is growing by 20 to 50 people a week. Recent media attention on the encampment prompted the Sacramento City Council last week to provide additional shelter beds in order to shut down the privately owned site. But as Africa Jones reports, many of the tent city's homeless say they will remain outdoors.
While some media outlets have branded the encampment along the American River in Sacramento the new face of the recession, many of Tent City's residents have been living on the property off and on for years. Residents say the site, owned by local utility and railroad companies, has even been divided into neighborhoods for the estimated 150 people living there. Anita, who didn't want to give her last name, lives atop a mound with her boyfriend, complete with three tents, one for sleeping, the others for storage. Anita says she wants her own place to live, but her disability check doesn't cover a deposit.
I've been out here over 7 or 8 years. I used to live right over the railroad tracks there until the police ran us off. With all the evictions and this and that, it's really hard for a person to find a place. We really don't have a choice where we want to be.
An onslaught of recent media attention on the encampment prompted Sacramento City Council and Mayor Kevin Johnson to extend homeless services last week in order to close Tent City down.
We have, as a city, swept this under the rug and ignored it. It was a dirty little secret that we did not want to talk about, and that's no longer acceptable in the city of Sacramento. The winter overflow shelter is going to be expanding. It will not close at the end of March.
City officials said they would add approximately 150 beds to the city's homeless shelters for Tent City residents. But homeless advocates say inadequate housing has been a problem for decades in Sacramento, and adding a couple of hundred beds to local shelters isn't enough.
There is a solution to homelessness. It's called enough housing to go around.
Joan Burke is the director of advocacy at Loaves and Fishes, a nonprofit which serves the homeless.
There are between 100 and 200 people living at the Tent City, but throughout Sacramento, there are 1,200 people sleeping outside on any given night. The shelter is a temporary emergency response, but that doesn't address the real need of people who are homeless, and that's to have a home of their own.
Although all of the Tent City residents I spoke to said they want permanent housing, many, like Anita, said if the city forcibly shuts down Tent City, they would sleep outside somewhere else.
We're probably going to find another campsite. With me having trouble breathing, I don't do shelters very well.
Where am I going to go? I think we're going to band up and not go anywhere.
Georgina, who also didn't want to give her last name, says due to a disability, she's been homeless off and on since the 1990s.
When I was 3 years old, my mom says, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I didn't say I wanted to be homeless. But I do, you know, being homeless, I met the most beautiful people. Because we're all in the same boat up the creek without a paddle. Here, I was here 8 years ago, and I've been back here about 2 years. Now they want me to move again.
Sounds like you've had problems with homelessness for a long time.
Well, I don't have problems with it. The only problem is that people keep running me off my earth.
Joan Burke says the city should find a safe, legal place for those who choose to remain outside until there is enough permanent housing.
We're not saying that people should spend their lives living in tents in the capital. Of course, people should have safe, decent, affordable, and accessible housing. But we're not providing that for people right now, and we do have a crisis. So if a legal campground would meet the short-term needs of folks better than a shelter and at less cost, it seems prudent to provide that.
City officials say they hope to close Tent City down by next month. In addition, Governor Schwarzenegger said he has asked the Obama administration to immediately provide nearly $2.5 million to aid Sacramento's homeless. Africa Jones, FSRN Sacramento.
The number one movie in Egypt now has caused a stir because of a scene in the film that addresses the thorny issue of divorce among Christians of the Coptic Orthodox Church. Egypt is home to at least 10 million Coptic Christians, making the community the largest religious minority in the country. In a report on the obstacles facing Coptic couples seeking divorce, FSRN's Ayo Batraoui speaks with the movie's screenwriter and director and those opposed to the issues raised by the film.
For the past 3 weeks, the movie Wahed Sift, meaning 1-0, has dominated the box office in Egypt. It's also caused a flurry of outrage because it's the first movie in over 100 years of Egyptian cinema to discuss the thorny issue of divorce among Coptic Christians in Egypt. While Egyptian law may grant a couple divorce, the Coptic Church has the right to refuse to acknowledge the court's ruling. And because marriage laws in Egypt are based on either Islamic or Coptic laws, Christians who seek the right to remarry must have the approval of the church. But the Coptic Church rarely issues a divorce except in three cases: adultery, conversion to another faith, or if a partner dies. The scene that led to condemnation by the Egyptian Orthodox Church and many of its followers concerns a 40-year-old Coptic woman played by actress Ilhan Shaheen. In the movie, her character, Naveen, wants permission from the church to remarry after 11 years in an unhealthy marriage. The problem's compounded when she finds out she's pregnant from her new partner. But in Egypt's conservative society, it would be unthinkable for her to conceive the baby out of wedlock. Naveen meets with her lawyer, and he offers her the only two options she has for remarrying, either to sue the church or convert to Islam.
The church? I'm going to sue the church?
Yes, it's your right since they gave him a permit to divorce you. So you sue and ask for your rights like he got his.
Honestly, is this even sensible? In order for me to get married, I sue the church?
This is the solution, Naveen. It's this, or there's another solution I wish we wouldn't have to reach. Convert to Islam.
Convert to Islam? No, not at all. I don't want to change my religion.
That's the only other solution.
So either I change my religion, or I live like this? I want to please God, but I don't know what to do. I'm sure God doesn't want this. I'm sure God didn't create us in this world to torment us.
Lawyer George Nicola spearheaded the campaign against the film. Nicola said that while he supports free speech, he's against any discussion that suggests a change in religious doctrine.
We have a verse that says there is no divorce without adultery, and what God has joined, let man not separate. So if God says this woman is for this man, she stays with him, and that's that. This is her fate and her destiny to bear. Even if he is not a good man, she tries to fix him. And the church allows a long period for engaged couples to take their time, because people know that marriage for us is forever.
But screenwriter Maryam Naoum disagrees. She said she's happy the film opened up doors to discussing divorce laws among Christians in Egypt. Being a Coptic Egyptian woman herself, she said the movie is about Egyptians and the everyday problems they face.
I found that if she is a Muslim woman in this situation, she will not have a problem. Because if she's married, she can get a divorce. And if she's already divorced, she can remarry. But Christian women are the only ones in this situation that struggle like this.
In 2008, the Cairo Administrative Court ruled that the church must grant Egyptians a remarriage permit based on an individual's constitutional rights. But many say it is unlikely the church will adhere to this ruling. Although the movie brought this issue to the public domain, director Kamla Abu Zikr says finding a solution anytime soon will be unlikely.
There are Christians all over the world, but I think they find some solutions for such problems. I think it's very difficult here in Egypt. It's very difficult. I think there will not be a solution. Even, I think after 100 years it will be, I don't know.
Screenwriter Naoum believes that there is a climate of fear among anyone wanting to speak out or discuss Coptic divorce laws.
If this was the reaction because I just addressed this issue in this movie without calling for any solutions or even offering any solutions to the problem, then no one will have the courage to say, the laws must change. It's not going to happen.
Naoum says the movie's title, Wahed Sifr, which represents the final score of the African Cup last year that Egypt won, is meant to represent how Egypt's only wins are in soccer. She adds that soccer is a source of distraction to people's problems. Aya Batraoui, FSRN, Cairo.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.